Station number 17629, Mr. David Ridley, Rail 3.
Mr. Ridley, Reel 3. Did you just have the one day at Bransworth Castle, Mr. Ridley?
Yes. We reported early in the morning to Bransworth Castle for inoculations and examination by the doctor and the issuing of equipment as far as we possibly could, because in those days the full uniform wasn't available. In fact, those that had Glengarry and hats, you used to have to swap them around if, because, you know, they didn't have the correct sizes. From there, we got on a bus to Willington. And my group was stationed in the Love Memorial Hall in Willington. Our son was a son, Rafferty, who's dead now, by the way. And his corporal was a chap called Thomas Thomas. While we were there, I can only remember that Sergeant Rafferty ever teaching one lesson, because he had trouble with some soldier who fired a shot at him, and he was always at Durham Crown Court, you know, giving evidence. And it was Thomas Thomas, the corporal, that did most of the teaching. We did 8 weeks, basically, foot drill. And after a period of time, we eventually had to clean our rifles and we started doing arms drill. It was rather primitive in those days because I don't suppose the British government would realise it was going to be a war. Therefore, we had no beds, we lay on the floor. We had no water. We had to wash in fire buckets because everything was frozen up. After a period of time, we were issued with palliasses and straw. And after a period of time again, then we got bed boards. And that was about as far as our luxury ever went. I remember Thomas Thomas said, well, you should subscribe towards an alarm clock to get you up in the morning. Our train was very lengthy, more than I've ever known in all my army service. We trained from, we got up at 6 o'clock in the morning and we didn't get back, we didn't stop training till 11 o'clock at night. After the 8 weeks train, we started to do route marches and field training. Route marches normally were twice a week. And at first it was 5 mile and doubled up. Eventually we were doing 30 odd mile in a route march.
What did you carry on a route march?
We carried what they called battle order, which was webbing with pouches on the side for to carry ammunition. A small pack on the back which carried your mess tin and your ground sheet and your cleaning equipment. Of course, you had your bayonet frog and your rifle, steel helmet and a respirator.
And did you have rests at all during the march?
The army lays down route march rules that you march for 50 minutes in the hour and you rest for 10. Unless it's a forced march, and if it's a forced march, you don't rest at all. You march, until you get there, wherever you're going.
Was it up to the officers to check your feet after a route march?
Yes, that was always done that. We had very few officers. We had a company commander, but they were mostly you know, dealt with the drill. Our main teachers was the platoon sergeant and his corporals. Nearly everyone had a sergeant and a corporal in a platoon. But soon ever we came off, we had to wash our feet and have a foot inspection. Oh, that was pretty good. Our eating arrangements, we all had to march up to the local community hall in Wellington. And there it was primitive again. We all had a knife, fork and spoon. That was about the most modern thing we ever had. We had tin plates and tin bowls for drinking our tea out of.
What were they feeding you on? What was army food?
Oh, the army food is also always wholesome. You had your bacon and eggs and things like that in the morning, porridge. And then you had your roast beefs and all that for lunch and so on. But you had three good meals a day. I cannot say I was ever hungry in the army. Even in battle, I was never hungry. I think the only time I ever felt a bit peckish, I was on a battle course. This is what General Montgomery brought out. And you were running miles and miles doing, you know, battle courses and everything. And when you got back, the normal meal that was issued wasn't enough for you. In fact, I went back to the same school in later years to do a mines course, and it was the same people and the same food, and the food was adequate. But that's about the only time I've ever felt a little bit peckish in the army.
Did you have a canteen in Wellington?
No. It's too early in the days.
Can we come back to the basic drills that you said that you were doing? Where did light infantry pace come into this?
Well, the light infantry pace gradually was taught because the Durham Light Infantry marched at 160 paces to the minute, and it took a long, long time for a recruit to reach that standard. In fact, it was taking so long that the power was to be adopted to 140 paces to the minute because it was taking too long for to a teacher chapter master at 160. I think I was about, the squad that I was in was about the last one that marched at 160.
Where did you do your drilling?
Just in the streets, the back streets in Wellington.
How did the civilian population take to you drilling there and being shouted at
The civilian population was marvellous. In fact, if a sergeant was starting to bully troops that were out there with a broom, you know, thumping them. There's one, when I was in the army a week, and then I was allowed to come home for a weekend. And when I told my mother where I was, she says, I've got some relations in Wellington. It was a lady called Swords. And I went and I hunted this lady out. Unfortunately, it wasn't the correct word, but it was some relation. And that lady was my second mother, Mrs. Swords from Wellington. She had two sons. Her husband was a miner. And if I didn't go down there for my supper every night, if I was on duty, on guard, my supper was sent up to us. She looked after me something marvellous. In fact, later on in my Masonic career, I went to Wellington as a master. I was a Reign Master at the time. And Reign Masters normally have to give a little speech, you know, at the festive board. And I stood up there and I thanked the people of Wellington for everything that it did for the troops. They were marvellous. They looked after you, something, you know. I can't say anything wrong with that.
You mentioned guard duties there. At what point in this initial training did you have to do those duties?
Well, after you were finally taught how to look after your rifles and be able to handle them and all that, they eventually started putting you on guard duties. It was just part of the drill, really. And we used to do guards on the cookhouses and various stores and on a little memorial hall. I always had a guard, but it was I don't know why we didn't need a guard, really. I think it was just a matter of, you know, teaching the guard duties.
What was the guard drill?
We did very little guard drill in respect. It was just more or less mountain and that taught you how to challenge and things like that. Later on, when we went to Brunswick camp, we used to do the full lot. And that was, you know, very, very complicated.
Foot drill, was that taught by numbers?
Pardon?
Foot drill, did you learn that by numbers?
Yes, when you first started, you all had to, you know, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, this sort of thing. And then eventually that was faded out. And you just had to, you know, by timing more or less. But at the beginning, you that's the way you teach recruits.
What was the background of the men that you were with coming into the training center?
Well, mostly miners. I don't think there was very much profession around in this area. I think they were all, nearly all miners' sons. Of course, I was the miner's son, and my father worked on the railway there, LNER, in those days.
Did you make friendships?
Yes, well, on the day we had to go to Brunswick, there was four of us went. One was called Denny Robinson, another chap called Murley, and a chap called Virgo, and myself. And us four, we stuck together all during our train. Our beds was all together. And eventually, after we did all our train, we were split up and sent to various places. Two got killed, Murley and Virgo, and two of us, Denny Robinson and myself, came back. We were both wounded. Denny Robinson landed off with the 2nd Battalion in Burma, and I finished off with the 1st Battalion in Italy. Murley was killed on D-Day. And Virgo was killed in the desert early on. I think he was in the mortars. How he got killed, I don't know.
Was there any initiation ceremony, bullying that was going on within the group?
No, not in our day, there wasn't that.
your NCOs that basically looked after you there, did they treat you pretty well all the time?
Oh, yes. It was strict. I mean, most of the instructors we had were regular soldiers. Later on, when I went to various battalions, I think what the British Army did, all the troops that was in India, it didn't matter what rank you were, whether you were private or corporal, what you were promoted and sent home to train British troops. And I met a lot of people, especially in the 17th Battalion, who were sons. And they weren't qualified to teach anyone because they didn't know it themselves. To teach recruits, you yourself have got to be taught. You've got to go on Carter courses then. And the army spent thousands of pounds on my train. I went all over the place train. And I finished off at Brunswick Camp. When we finally moved into Brunswick Camp, I finished off there as an instructor. And I rose to the rank of Lance Sergeant before I was transferred to the 17th Battalion. But the instructors we had were very good. There's only the two I remember. There's a chap called Rasmussen, come from Middlesbrough. And I finally met him in... again in the 1st Battalion. In fact, I was on leave in Cairo, and a lot of my friends that had been sent abroad before me, so I met them. And I went up to a place called Mina, which was at the foot of the pyramids. And the 1st Battalion was there. This is when they got chased out of one of the Mediterranean islands that were in there. Crete, I think it was.
Cos.
When I had to evacuate that, this half of the 17th Battalion reinforced the 1st Battalion. And I met them in, as I said, in Cairo. And I went and asked the colonel, who was the Colonel Vaux of Vaux's Breweries here, if he would accept me. Well, I'd been on a cattle trip for about 15 weeks, and I didn't look very much like a good soldier. The battle dress was all... Well, when I pulled my paper out and showed him all the courses I'd been on, he accepted it. And I took over this Rasmussen's platoon, because he was in hospital. And our company command was Major Gray. Would never give him the platoon back. He kept me, and he let Raz go to another...
We'll come to that, of course, later on in the story. To come back to Willington, what leisure activities did you get up to when your duties were over and your training was for the day?
Well, he had none during the week, because, as I say, we would train right up to 11 o'clock at night. And then on a weekend, if we were allowed home on a weekend, I used to come home. I took my cycle there, and I used to cycle to Portland Fell from Willington. And I was caught in my pleasant good lady here, Vera. And there's not much you could do. I got the cinema, the dance, and that was it. In those days, there was no... not such a thing as going down to the local pub. I mean, I didn't drink or nothing in those days.
What time was Reveille?
6 every morning, 6 o'clock.
What happened immediately that you were aroused?
Well, at Willington, it was all, as I say, Thomas's alarm clock that we bought used to go off. And he used to lie in bed, tell him when to get up and get washed and shaved and get dressed.
I think you said most of this was with cold water, of course.
It was, yes.
When you dressed, and presumably you cleaned up your areas, is
that correct? Oh, yes. You had the local... First of all, you got up and you got washed and shaved, if you shaved. I didn't shave in those days. I'll tell you a story about that later on. But you got washed and shaved, made your bed up, cleaned the barrack room up, and cleaned the outside if it was necessary. And then by that time, in fact, you pushed, because they didn't give you much time. You had to parade for breakfast about 7 o'clock. You had to march up to the dining room, have your breakfast. And when he came back, put your vest in and bowl and that away, knife and fork, and then you were outside on whatever was scheduled for that day. Drill, mostly.
Did you have PT?
Oh, yes, uh-huh. Yes. That was always a major thing, especially at Bransford Camp when we all moved in. It was a mass PT on the square, with everywhere, you had nearly 2,000 troops there. And then they started to bring music in, which was a lot lightning, you know. It's something like they have on the television these days. But, yes.
So then you have a spell of PT, and then you do various drills or whatever that you're teaching. What time was lunch?
Normally about 12.
How long did you get?
You got about an hour.
And this was a major meal?
But
it was, really.
You had a decent breakfast, a good lunch, and a sort of high tea, and that was it. No supper, unless you were on guard duty. If you're on guard duty, you used to get a tea and a few sandwiches.
Did the pattern of the afternoon follow the same as what you'd been doing in the morning? The pattern of drills, etc., and training in the afternoon, was it the same as the morning?
No, you'd, first of all, if you were doing, we'll say, turning about, you'd practice that for, say, an hour. And then in the afternoon when he went out, he said, right, and they would practice for about 10 minutes to see that you'd more absorbed what the basic principles were.
What time was your tea break, high tea break?
Didn't have any. Now, there were no brakes, not in the initial train. In the initial train, it was 6 o'clock in the morning, 11, and you had your break for breakfast and lunch and tea, and that was that. And in fact, it amazed me because when I became in, so when, I mean, we used to finish at 4 or 5, it was nothing like 11 o'clock. The only time you train at 11 o'clock, if you were a naughty boy and you do an extra drill. But
you would be trained to keep your equipment clean.
Oh yes.
How was that done?
Well, you were allowed so much money per week for cleaning equipment, like shoe polish and brush oil and things like that. And you had to keep your own equipment clean. And you bought it from the quartermaster stores, the Blanco and things like that. And that was when you went on guard duty, eventually when you more or less fully trained, that was one of the major things. You used to inspect your equipment to make sure it was all right. And especially your weapon. Now, the weapon that I was issued with, the first day when we were taught how to, take the bolt out and the magazine out to clean it, we couldn't either get the bolt or the magazine out of my rifle. So I had to go to the stores and get a new one. And one day I got some old soldier's rifle. And it was a beauty. The barrel was like silver. Now the rifle we issued, it was thick with grease. And then the poor chaps had to sit cleaning all the grease off it. I was sitting with a brand new clean rifle. And I held on to that rifle as long as I could. But there were so short of weapons at Bransford, the Bransford camp, when a draft used to go away, they all had to be issued with the Enfield rifles. And we had to give them up to complete the quota for the draft that was going away. So eventually I had to give it up. But it was a beautiful rifle.
What was the process for cleaning your rifle? How did you clean your rifle?
Well, you had a linen cloth called flannet, which was marked off in sections measuring 2 inches by 4. That was cut off and it was put in a string, what they call a pull through with a weight on the end. That's how you used to clean the barrel. If you'd been firing your rifle, you could put a wire gauze on, to take the rough off. And the other, you had in the butt of your rifle, you had an oil bottle and you pulled it. That's where you used to keep them. And it was just the flannet you were issued with and any rag that you used to possess yourself to keep it clean.
Were there strict regulations for handling your weapon?
Oh, yes, very.
Both on duty and off duty?
Yes, very. You were never taught. You were taught never to point a rifle at anybody, because there's an old saying is, the empty rifle is always the one that kills someone. And the thing happened like that with me. I was at Brunson's Castle at the time on a Carter course, and we were in line picket, and we got called out, and we had to line the keep, that keep there. We had to line the keep, and this chap was a bit late, and he came. And I says, have you charged your rifle? He said, well, I had to charge your rifle. He says, no, I haven't. And he went, bang. And I bet to this day there's a bullet hole under there. Didn't kill anybody, right? But I have seen odd people get, shot by careless people. You never point a rifle at anybody unless you it's the enemy.
And presumably the punishment was severe.
Oh, yes, if you were caught doing anything wrong with a rifle, yes, you'll hold up in front of the company command and get so many days CB or whatever it was. But you had to have deterrence to stop people from doing these things. Because you see with kiddies playing cowboys and Indians, they're pointing rifles but they only made a Bakelite. You would get to see them in the army when recruits first get together. I mean, the new newfoundlanders getting a weapon put into their hands. But if you were caught pointing a rifle at anyone, you were for it.
How did you take to that initial imposition of discipline in the army?
Well, I accepted it very well, I thought. I mean, I was always disciplined at home. I mean, my father was the ruling body there. And even when I went into the army, it was the same thing. I accepted. And I was the type where an order given was an order obeyed, whether you liked it or not. And I liked the army. See? And when we come to do weapon training and being taught how to use machine guns and things, I was very interested because I could absorb it. I was the type that if I saw a thing being done, I could absorb it straight away. Give me a book and I would be there all day and I would never get no further. But show me how to stick a brain gun and I would do it. In fact, I could do blindfolded at the finish.
Was this true of all the men in your section, for example? Did all the men take to the army pretty well?
No, not all of them. We had a chap called Shelley. I used to go to school with him. And he would never make a soldier. Because he physically wasn't capable of it. He was that wide, about 2 foot wide and about 4 foot high. And he was just retarded a little. In fact, I heard tales about him. He's, if he didn't want to go to school, he used to get under the bed. And he was so strong, very, very strong. He was so strong his mother couldn't get him out. And in fact, I've seen in Love Memorial Hall, somebody tried to take a brush off him, and he just flipped him through the air. He's very strong. And eventually got discharged him because he would never make a soldier. Not in any way. Whether it was, cleaning latrines or anything like that, he just hadn't the mentality to do it. But most were all right.
We've mentioned the punishments for mishandling a rifle. What are the common punishments were there in those early days in the army?
Well, it was nearly always confined to barracks, and then you had to report to the cookhouse, a peel of, masses and masses of potatoes, clean the equipment, and then if it was severe, that something very dangerous that you're doing, and you got field train, I think they called it. You would load it up with all your equipment, and full marching order, not just battle order, full marching order. I can't remember the weight of that, but it was terrific. And you'll march round and round and round the square, or double round the square. Really pull at you that way. And then, if you went to the top level of it, you'll put in prison.
What kind of thing might you have done to incur the smaller punishments, the daily kind of thing that you might have done?
Well, that's a doing some pointing a rifle at somebody that you shouldn't have done, being late on parade, being idle on parade, and in fact I had a thing called dumb insolence. That was, you didn't say anything to anyone, but you showed it in your face that you've hit at the blue sight of the sergeant that was talking to you or something like that, and that was dumb insolence. And you could even get punished for that in those days.
Did you get any gas precautions training?
No, not really. No. I can't remember. No.
The bayonet, when was that issued to you, the bayonet?
Oh, straight away, with the rifle.
And did you do bayonet training?
Oh, yes, uh-huh.
Yeah. Was that considered to be a very important part of your training?
Well, it's not a part that I really like, but I suppose it should be an important. But I've never had to use a bayonet. I've never been in a bayonet charge. I've never ever seen a one. I've been attacked by the enemy, by the Germans out in Italy, and I never saw anybody with a bayonet on. In fact, I was with the 10th Indian Division, evidently, and the only naked stealer I ever saw was the Gurkhas. When the Gurkha went in, when he got anywhere near to the enemy, he used to put his rifle in his left hand and draw his kukri.